Possible in part by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, offering pinch-proof doors, keyless digital entries, and lifetime manufacturer's warranties. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580 and online at WILL.UIUC.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in. Are you looking for something new to try in the kitchen? Or have you tried something new recently that you'd like to tell us about? Well, I hope you'll stay tuned. Today we're going to take a look at recent recipes from books, magazines, newspapers, and the internet. Food writer Molly Stevens is our guest. She's one of the editors of the Best American Recipes series, most recently the Best American Recipes 2004-2005. Stevens says the watchword for this year, 2004-2005, is homey, but she's quick to add, don't confuse homey with plain or boring. And I would add, there are recipes here that, for me, are certainly new and interesting. Nothing boring here. There are a number of very good salads here. And last night I made a salad called Moroccan Herb Salad. Herbs, garlic, olive oil, olives, and pickled lemons. We used it as a spread on some toasted and cooled Italian bread. It was quite refreshing and just the thing for a hot evening. Listeners, I hope you'll join us this afternoon with a telephone call. Your questions and comments are invited. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Let me tell you a bit about our guest. Molly Stevens is the author of All About Braising and the co-author of One Potato, Two Potato. She's a contributing editor for Fine Cooking. Her cookbook, The Best American Recipes, is the co-author for The Best American Recipes is Fran McCullough. The book's introduction this year was written by Bobby Flay, the publisher, Houghton Mifflin. 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Molly Stevens, thanks so much for tuning in this afternoon.
Hello.
Hi, thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you, Celeste. It's nice to be here.
Yeah. Would you talk about Moroccan herb salad as I made it last night? Maybe we could start there?
Sure, that's a great choice. It's that's a recipe from Paula Wolfert, and I think as you explained it, you used it more as a spread than a salad. It's not the salad, you know, as we think of a tossed green salad. It's a little bit different than that because the herbs actually get blanched or cooked a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
But Paula Wolfert is just an expert on Mediterranean and especially Moroccan food, a real authority, and it's just this wonderful mix of herbs and spinach and cilantro, and then it's got the little paprika and lemon juice, and then those preserved lemon rinds, the Moroccan lemon preserved lemons you talked about.
Yeah.
But it's just got all these great flavors of olives, paprika, cayenne, cumin, and a really, you know, there's a little bit of cooking involved, but very little, and something wonderfully, as you said, refreshing for these hot days.
Yeah. Well, we had it with some cold boiled shrimp, and I thought it would be nice in addition to having that traditional cocktail sauce that's loaded with wonderful horseradish,
yeah,
that we would have this Moroccan herb salad. And it was terrific paired with the shrimp.
Yeah, and in Morocco, that's a great idea because it's more, I mean, you're calling it a salad and more a spread or a dip.
It's a little bit more like a pesto almost.
Yeah, that's a great comparison. And everything actually gets steamed together. So it, because sometimes with herb salad, some of the herbs are too bitter or to just eat raw like this. So, and actually they use, certainly the leaves they use in Morocco are nothing like what we can get here. But this time of year, you can use just anything out of your garden.
Yeah. And the preserved lemons, that was a treat. I had never had them before.
And now, were you able to find those?
Yes.
Great.
Yes, I went to the International Grocery, one of them, and sure enough, there they were.
Yep.
I took them home, and before I got them out of the store, though, the woman who waited on me said, "What are you going to do with those?" And I told her, and she said, "You know, my mother used to make these."
Really?
Yeah.
Huh. You know, it's so fascinating what's happened, and one of the things about doing Best American that's so really fun is having to watch this stuff year by year, and, you know, ingredients that nobody'd heard of, you know, 20 years ago and were almost impossible to find 10 years ago and are now sort of all over the place in the international section of the supermarket or whatever. And these preserved lemons are a good example. They're used in a lot of Middle Eastern, especially Moroccan cooking. Now, if you don't have them or if you don't have a good grocery store, you can make the salad without them, too.
Yeah, just use a little. I think just a little tiny lemon zest would be okay.
Yeah, it's not the same thing, but it's and that's one of the things that we really we have fun doing in the book is we write what we call notes from our test kitchen, and where we write, you know, maybe some of the information that the recipe didn't give you, or, well, if you don't have Moroccan lemons, you can make this with just a little lemon zest, and it won't be the same thing, but it'll be very, very,
very
good.
Close.
Yeah.
Now, you and your co-editor, Fran McCullough,
yes.
Do you approach food and recipes with a similar eye?
You mean sort of between the two of us?
Yeah,
or do we realize that we have some things that we share, like we both love lemon, things like that. But we also have different, like I really love, you know, meats and roasts and things, and she dives right into the soups and that sort of thing. So we definitely have different, and I'm more, my background's more technical, meaning I learned to cook sort of in France where things are very classical and by the book, and hers is not quite that. So we do have a different approach, which is nice, but then a common ground, so we agree upon most things. I can't think of a recipe that she would put in that I would disagree with, and because if we don't both love it, then it doesn't make it.
Yeah. How do you look over a recipe for the first time? How do you see it?
It's hard to articulate because it's that, I like to say, when you're sitting in the doctor's office or you're, you know, waiting in a waiting room and you're flipping through a magazine, what is it that stops you on one recipe over, if you're a person who likes food and likes to cook like I am, and, you know, what is it that grabs your eye with a recipe? And there are a few things. One of the most common is that it looks really simple but really good.
Mm-hmm.
And that's always, you know, something that has, I know, for example, there's some biscuits in this book that have two ingredients. And we're immediately like, okay, come on, is this really going to work, right? And so something that looks really simple but really good, that's a great one. Another thing we love is to look for something that's sort of something where, not a classic, but a standard that's been turned on its head a little bit. So, for example, there's a shrimp cocktail in this book but instead of just the ordinary you were talking about earlier, the cocktail sauce, it's a spicy jalapeno chili based sauce. So it's familiar, but there's a twist. That's something we really like to look for. And then if it's something, or another thing is something that solves a problem, one of my favorite recipes in this collection is a mocha pudding. And it's, you just, I forget how many ingredients, maybe four ingredients, but you just whip it together in a blender. It's the fastest thing in the world, and it's just this wonderful, you know, chocolate, coffee, mocha pudding that people just, you know, go weak in the knees over.
And there's another pudding in here, double chocolate pudding.
Yes.
That looks to die for.
Yes, yes. And that one is, and that's a very classic sort of American, you know, the old-fashioned kind of pudding, not so dense is what the mocha pudding. But we both, Fran and myself, have a big preservationist streak in that we love lost recipes or uncovered. Like Country Captain is something that was around a long time ago, and sort of it's a curried chicken dish from the South, and we love finding recipes like that have sort of been resurrected.
Yeah, and there's a grits recipe too, right?
Yes, yes.
That's kind of revved up.
Yep, exactly. And that's, you know, revved up and dressed up too, gussied up a little bit in a casserole dish, the green chili cheese grits, and the other thing, I mean, this is harder to tell on the page, and Celeste would be have to tell you, for as many times we've done this collection, we're on our seventh year now,
wow,
we still get duped into recipes. And you'd think we'd get so good that we could just look and say, ah, it's not worth it. But we're always saying, you know, maybe this could... And we sometimes it's as many as 5 or 6 to 1 of recipes that we test and don't make it in the collection. So it's not just looks good on the page. It has to really deliver. And one of our true tests, and I'm just, this story comes from the grits, because I remember when we served this, I mean, everyone just divided seconds, thirds, licked the bowl, you know, that kind of thing. And that's always a sign when people can't stop eating something.
Yeah, you or they ask you for the recipe, you know.
When they ask you for the recipe, yeah, you know it's a winner. Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Lucky your friends and family.
Yeah. For the most part, when they come over and it's the, and you get the less, you know, the not the winner bunch, then. My husband's always saying, you know, we make dinner, and he looks at me and says, are we testing? Is this the best, or can I just eat?
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Molly Stevens, our guest this afternoon, co-editor of the Best American Recipes, the latest in the series, 2004-2005. My name is Celeste Quinn. And listeners, you can join us this afternoon with your questions, comments, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455, 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Well, speaking of conservation, one of the top 10 recipes is a casserole, spinach and artichoke casserole. This looks like something that could come from a mom's or a grandmom's recipe collection.
Yeah, this one really surprised us, and I think one of the details about this recipe, this comes from Julie Reed, who is from New Orleans, writes a lot about New Orleans, but also writes quite a bit in the New York Times Magazine. And this is one of those where we read about it, and then we read about someone, because it's made with canned artichokes, and it's sort of the old artichoke dip, but and frozen spinach, and we read about someone who thought, well, it's got to be better with, you know, fresh ingredients. And they went and they made it with, you know, with fresh artichokes, which they peeled and, you know, cut up and trimmed and all of that. And it was good, but it wasn't a whole lot better. So it's a Ritz cracker casserole. And you serve it to your most snobby food friends, and they're going to love it. It's so delicious, cheesy. And you can use it as a side dish or even as a starter course, a first course kind of cocktail party thing.
Yeah, sounds great. Yeah. I'm looking forward to preparing this for my mother-in-law. I think she would really like it. She's not a vegetable eater, but I think she would go for this big time.
Yeah, well, the butter and the cream cheese in there helps.
Yeah.
With any vegetables.
And those buttery cracker crumbs.
Right.
Ritz cracker crumbs.
But we really have fun, you know, having sort of such a range in it of things, like, you know, just talking about the Moroccan herb salad with preserved lemon and the artichoke and Ritz cracker casserole, you know, ends of the spectrum kind of.
Yeah.
And that's really fun to look at recipes that way.
Yeah. It was fun finding something new to try and being introduced to those preserved lemons, because I thought, oh my gosh, what am I going to do with all these?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm starting to think now, well, I think this would taste really good with chicken.
Yeah, you know, I use them with chicken a lot, and what I love to, I roast chicken, and I just take a whole one or a half one and stick it in the cavity as the chicken roasts.
Yeah.
And it perfumes the whole chicken.
Sounds great.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, how many, you said you've been doing this now, this is the seventh?
This, the one we're looking at is the sixth, and the seventh one is on its way for next year. So we've done seven so far.
Yeah, and I pulled it up on Amazon. It says it's not available yet, but the coming edition, the foreword, will be by Mario Batali.
Yeah, it will be by Mario, and we usually have a recipe of his in every year, and... It's every year we think, oh gosh, here we go again, and it's amazing what we find out there. There are new things, there's exciting things every year, and it's sometimes you think there can't be anything new, but there really is.
Yeah. Can you give us a sneak preview?
Oh gosh, yeah, there's some of our favorites coming up from next year. There's a soup that I'm in love with right now. It's a carrot ginger soup, but what makes it, which is wonderful soup and very fragrant and perfumey, but it's the creme fraiche, a little like sour cream made with lime drizzle that goes on top. So it's this lime ginger carrot thing that's absolutely delicious. And then another one that right about now is the ginger lemon iced tea. Again, ginger's a huge, huge flavor. And then the one that my editor absolutely fell in love with, our editor at Houghton Mifflin, is the brown sugar sour cream cheesecake. Mm. That one, we delivered the manuscript. I took her half the cheesecake along with the manuscript, and I'm not sure which she was happier to receive. So there's some great things coming up in it.
Keep your editor happy.
Yes, it's important.
That's important.
Yeah.
You know, tell us a little bit more about the carrot ginger soup, because for years we've been making at our house a silver palette carrot orange soup, and everybody loves it. But this is ginger is in there.
Yeah, this is and this is from a book called Simply Elegant Soup, and it's carrots, some broth, fresh ginger that gets grated, and then a little bit of garlic, a little bit of onion. But the predominant flavor is the sweetness of the carrots that's offset by, because ginger, when you use enough, you know, has a little heat to it too.
Mm-hmm.
And then you make a little ginger oil before you make the soup by taking just plain vegetable or canola oil and infusing it with ground ginger and let it sit. And so you get the spicy little oil that goes on top to really bring out the ginger flavor. And then some fresh lime zest and lime juice. So really bright, you know, flavors.
Yeah.
Really
sounds
great.
Like, sounds like a great way to start a holiday.
Yeah, dinner. Yeah, and it's pretty too. The color is great. And we also have another soup that we just fell in love with is this soup from a chef who cooks at a private school in Manhattan. And we found this recipe because it was whizzing around email. All the parents were asking for this recipe because their kids were coming home from school. And this is a French chef who got hired to cook for a private school and was just appalled that the kids wouldn't eat any vegetables when he got there. And so he set off on a mission to get these kids to eat vegetables and had them clamoring for rutabagas and cauliflower, and by the end of it, I mean, it's a wonderful story. But he has this cauliflower soup that is, it's a really simple, just cauliflower soup with a little bit of coriander and some chives, and it's hard to say what makes it so good, but it's just got this, you know how cauliflower, if you cook it right, it can be very, very sweet,
mm-hmm.
But otherwise it can be kind of stinky.
Yeah.
But he gets all the goodness out of it. So we love finding recipes like that.
Yeah.
In undiscovered places, that's the most fun. We look in all the big cookbooks, and we look in little cookbooks, and we look in self-published cookbooks. We have one of the dips in the book that that you have there, Celeste, is from an Iraqi cookbook that was self-published, and it's just 800-page history of Iraqi cuisine.
How did you run across something like that?
I read it in a newsletter or in somebody's web blog or something. You know, we just keep looking and saw a reference to this and thought, that's a fascinating. I'd never read a book on Iraqi cuisine. And so we wrote away for it. So it's really, I mean, fun to dig around like that in the supermarket flyers and then just to find out what everybody else might not see. That one of the chicken recipes in this collection is from a supermarket flyer in Western New York. And it's great. And it's one of those, I happened to be in the supermarket with my sister one day. She lives out there and the chef was there cooking this little chicken salt and boca, he called it, and we took a little taste, and she said, oh my gosh, let's go make that for dinner. And we did, and it was great, so we made it in the book.
Boy. Now, what are the elements in that dish?
Chicken salt and boca. It's chicken with some ham, a little prosciutto and sage that sort of get pounded together a little bit, and then what's wonderful about it is it's made with escarole and white beans, and so it ends up being a meal in one dish.
Mm.
After you put it all together, and it's got the little savory from the prosciutto, and the chicken, you just cook it just enough so it's still juicy, and then the juices, you use a little broth in with the beans and the escarole, so it all stays not quite soupy, but very, very juicy. Easy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Speaking of things that are all, you know, dinner all in one fell swoop, there are a couple of salads in the book. Spinach and tabbouleh salad with feta and olives. I think you could make a meal out of that. And Sardinian rice salad with tuna, olives, and capers.
Yeah, yeah. Especially this time of year when, you know, the less time you have to cook, the better.
Yeah, and if it's not, you don't have to get, you know, when you sit down, it's cool and refreshing.
Mm-hmm.
That really makes a big difference.
Yeah, and that rice salad has got the, it's also got hard-cooked eggs in it, and as well as the tuna, so it's sort of a, I mean, if you've had a salad niçoise, it would be familiar to you, but this, because of the grain, the rice and the basmati rice, it makes it even more, you know, more of a meal, really.
Yeah.
And really colorful, too, which is great.
Yeah. And one of the surprising things to me here is the technique of you boil the rice in lots of salted water until
mm-hmm.
it's tender, not like you usually cook rice where you cook it and then let it steam.
Yeah.
This is boiling the rice.
Almost like you cook pasta.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Then it's not, you still have that great taste of that teksmati or basmati rice, but it's not as sticky, right?
Right. And it's a technique that if you're serving rice cold, you can do, because you need to drain it, you know, and sort of shake off all the excess water. So it wouldn't work if you were trying to just serve warm rice with dinner, really. But it's great if you're putting a vinaigrette on it afterwards. It just absorbs all that flavor.
Yeah. Should we run down this recipe? Do you have that book with you?
Sure. The
Sardinian rice salad.
Sure, yeah. You bring a big pot of water, about 6 cups of water, to a boil. And then it's 2 cups of either basmati or teksmati, which is a American-grown version of basmati rice. And cook, as you said, uncovered like pasta. Boil it for about 12 minutes until it's tender. And then drain it and shake it off. Oh, and I should have mentioned the water should be salted, as with pasta. You always want to salt your cooking water. And then once that's cooled, you toss in some lemon juice, 1/3 cup of lemon juice, 1/4 cup of extra virgin olive oil, and that's your dressing. And then you add all the other wonderful crunchy bits, which are, I'll go through them. We've got scallions, 8 scallions sliced, 2 celery ribs also sliced, 1/3 cup of cornichon or gherkins or the little pickles, 1/3 cup of pitted olives, Kalamata olives, 1/4 cup of chopped parsley, 2 tablespoons drained capers, 1 teaspoon finely grated lemon zest, and then what gives it its protein is you've got 2 cans of tuna that you've drained and left in chunks so they don't get too flaked up, so it keeps it prettier and not quite as hodgepodge, and then 2 hard-boiled eggs that have used sliced. And you can serve it. The nice thing about this is it can sit. It'll still be a little warm when you make it, or you can let it sit mm-hmm. room temperature, too.
Mm. Sardinian rice salad with tuna,
yep.
olives, and capers.
Yeah.
There's a keeper.
That's a keeper, exactly. That's what we look for, is recipes. You say that's a keeper. It's one you make again and again.
Yeah.
Yep.
What does your house look like in terms of the books and the pamphlets and the clippings? And
well, I try to keep most of it in up. I have keep my office upstairs, so it's not, but it works its way downstairs. I do have 2 refrigerators because sometimes there's so much food. But there are I have lots of boxes of books and things that come in. And what I really try to do is every year when we finish the project,
mm-hmm.
is go through the books that came in and the books that I've looked at and cull them and keep the ones that I really know I'll use, and then go through and weed out some of the other ones, because mm-hmm. there are enormous amount of books every year. But it's really, you know, the great fun of this project is it just forces me to look at all this stuff that comes out every year, and it's really, it's encouraging, because people say, oh, you know, you hear all this doom and gloom that people aren't cooking anymore. It's not true. People cook all the time. I think Americans are cooking. Maybe we're cooking differently, but we're still cooking.
Yeah.
So it's fun to see what we're cooking.
There have got to be hundreds of cookbooks that come out every year.
Oh, yeah.
At least.
Yeah. Yeah, there really are. There really are. And I think, I don't have the number, but I've heard upwards of between, you know, 250 and 300 or something. which wouldn't surprise me at all. And then, I mean, if you take in all the junior league cookbooks and all of that, but, you know, certainly mainstream publishing. And we do our best. I know we miss some, but we keep looking. And the nice thing is a good recipe will always pop back up again.
Yeah.
And recipes have a interesting way of circulating.
Mm-hmm.
And this is something that Fran is very, very good at, is recognizing a sort of the genesis of a recipe or the pedigree. And I'm trying to remember an example, but I'll come up with something, and she'll say, "Oh yes, that's Marion Cunningham's recipe from 8 years ago," or you know, something like that. And good recipes keep turning up.
Hmm. What were the first cookbooks that you really delved into, and they're still with you, and you loved them to death?
Myself personally,
yeah.
The Richard Olney cookbooks, which are the Simple French Cooking and the French Menu Cookbook, and then an author, James Peterson, who has written a sauces book and a soups book. Those books have always been very important to me. And James Beard. I mean, I just go back into those again and again.
Yeah. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Cookbook writer, food writer, Molly Stevens, our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. She's the author of All About Braising. She's the co-author of One Potato, Two Potato, and she's a contributing editor for Fine Cooking. She and Fran McCullough are the series editors for The Best American Recipes. This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. If you're looking for something new to try in the kitchen, give us a call. Talk with Molly Stevens. Or maybe you've tried something recently that you'd like to share with us. Give us a call. Join the discussion. 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Well, I have had the great pleasure of looking at your book, All About Braising, and I think I have seen it at the library, and I think it is one that I will go out and invest in.
Wow.
And that's where, you know, that's how I kind of decide if I'm going to buy a cookbook.
Mm-hmm.
I go to the library,
mm-hmm.
and I take it out, and I kind of look at it, and I work with it, and then I go, this one I will buy. So anyway, in now, moving from that to the best American recipes, one of the top 10 recipes, braised beef short ribs Chinese style.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, this is a recipe from Leslie Revson. And, I mean, short ribs have become a real darling of, you know, it's interesting how we were talking before about an ingredient will not even be available and suddenly is everybody's favorite. And short ribs is certainly one of those ingredients that has become very popular. And it's funny because they've been around forever and they used to be a cut that butchers couldn't sell. But as braising becomes sort of more popular, or resurrected, I should say. But what the thing about short ribs is they're a tough, gnarly cut of meat. But they have this great flavor locked into them, so the trick is to braise them slowly and bring out all that great meaty flavor. And what Leslie Revson does in this book is she braises them in a sort of Chinese-style flavor of soy sauce, dry sherry, you could use dry white wine as well, a little bit of brown sugar, and some star anise, which is the spice that has a sort of sweet, almost licorice-y flavor to it. A little bit of garlic and then some scallions and again some ginger. And it just, it's this wonderful, the soy gives it this great mahogany color and then the ginger and the star anise give it this great perfume. So they're kind of sweet and meaty and you really, aside from browning the ribs and putting these ingredients in the pot, you just walk away and come back, you know, 2.5-3 hours later and the ribs are fall off the bone tender and just infused with this incredible flavor.
That sounds great. And you can do this ahead of time.
Yeah.
And you can have it in the refrigerator for almost a week or in the freezer for a couple of months.
Yeah. And they get even better the day, you know, a day or two as they sit in the fridge. The flavors just really infuse the meat. It's a great, great way to cook short ribs.
Yeah. Talk with us about braising. I think it's a technique that we're going to really, that's why I really want to get all about braising, is because as cuts of meat have become tougher, this is a really good way to cook them.
Yeah, and it's sort of, it's interesting because braising, second to cooking over live fire, braising is the oldest cooking method there is. You put food in a pot with a little bit of liquid and put a lid on it, and that's braising. But it's sort of fallen out of favor over as we got all excited about roasting and grilling is so sexy and stir frying and all these things and braising. Braising is what our grandmothers did and our mothers did, and now it's gaining favor again, which is wonderful, because what you get is it's a slow way of cooking, meaning you can't. I mean, there's some quicker braises, but it's not flash in the pan. But you get these incredible flavors. And you, as you said, you can use what they call the lesser cuts of meat, the chuck and the shoulder and the ribs and things like that, which traditionally cost a little less, but also they have more flavor.
Mm.
Filet mignon is wonderful, but it doesn't have the rich flavor that you get from, say, short ribs or chuck steak or something.
Yeah.
So it's really... It's a kind of cooking that I love, because the whole is greater than the sum of the parts.
Uh-huh.
That, something more than just the separate ingredients you put in evolves out of the pot at the end, and I think there's something very, very satisfying about it.
Yeah, and it smells wonderful.
Mm-hmm, fills your house with these great aromas. Yeah. And it's actually very, the nice thing, you were talking about the braising book that I wrote. After it came out, I get a lot of people calling, saying these recipes, they work so well, they're so wonderful. I almost feel like I'm cheating, because with braising, it's really hard to screw it up. Because it's such, when you cook slowly, I think of it as driving a car. If you're driving really fast, it's hard to stop quickly, but if you're going slowly, you can. And with braising, if you leave it 5 minutes less, 10 minutes too long, it doesn't make that big of a difference.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas if you're grilling a steak, boy, you leave it on there a minute too long and you could ruin the steak,
Yeah.
Braising's much more forgiving.
Yeah. And you don't need any fancy equipment.
No.
You need a heavy pot.
Yep. Yep. If you cook at all, you've got pots in your kitchen that
right.
you can braise in. Yeah.
And one of the great revelations in All About Braising to me was to intensify that braising action, is you can put a little piece of foil on top of what you've got cooking.
Right.
So you can adjust, so to speak, your pot.
Yeah.
So if you've got a great big pot, you can still use it.
Exactly. Because you want the food to be sort of snug in the pot, not jammed in, but snug enough that you have a very concentrated, because it's all about of concentrating the liquid, and it steams, and then it drips down from the condenses and drips down. So if the pot's huge and it's swimming in there, it will be more dilute. So if you just put some foil or parchment paper in there and lower the top, really make a false lid, down low,
mm-hmm.
you turn a big pot into a little pot.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, not
false,
hard at all.
False
yeah.
lid.
Yeah.
Well, back to Best American Recipes.
Yeah.
Year to year, are there ingredients that you find popping up everywhere?
Yeah, it's really been interesting how, and we love to go back and look at our past, what was top 10, and what seems to be happening is things, the sort of influx of all the, first it was Mexican, then it was brought into Latin, and then it's gone to Spanish. Spanish ingredients, it's incredible what you can get, what you didn't used to be able to get, the Spanish paprikas and the pimenton peppers and all these things that people fall in love with. And our facility, I think, is what's even more, the ingredients themselves, certainly, but our facility with them, meaning that people are less afraid of or not intimidated by a spice rub that includes, dried chipotle peppers or fresh chipotle or, canned chipotle peppers and things like that, whereas before it was it'd have to be a very special dish to put those in. And it's funny because we like bacon. It's incredible, our love affair with bacon in this country.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it just keeps coming, gets stronger every year almost. And then from bacon, it transfers to pancetta, which is, of course, the Italian bacon. And so you see these things kind of, and we try to do two things in the book. We try to represent that this is, you know, everywhere, that, you know, but we don't want to have every recipe have bacon in it either, you know, so we're trying to reflect what's going on, but also, you know, put balance in the book as well. Mm. Creme fraiche is an ingredient that you'd had to make your own 5 years ago, and now it's available in lots of supermarkets, and that's the, I guess it's best described as sort of a French sour cream, and it's in, you know, lots and lots of recipes right now.
Is there a trendy ingredient just beginning to show itself at the moment?
Well, certainly the Spanish paprika that seems that it's called pimenton and just seems to be, it's a smoked paprika, as well as the Hungarian paprika, which we've all sort of grown up on, is becoming more and more available and also more called for in lots of recipes. Another thing I think of is the Japanese breadcrumbs called panko.
Mm-hmm.
Again, something that used to be only seen in a Japanese recipe or for something Japanese style. And now there's a recipe in here, for example, where you take fat asparagus spears and coat them in a mix of just regular mayonnaise and mustard and then roll them in panko and roast them in an oven, pretty hot oven, and serve them either as a side dish or as a, I love them as a starter, as an appetizer. And they're it's incredibly delicious.
Mm.
But again, this, you know, panko and asparagus and mayonnaise mustard, that's not exactly, you know, a normal use of those, but they're just, you couldn't do it with other breadcrumbs. And now, you know, you just go find the aisle that's got the sushi ingredients or the Japanese ingredients or whatever, however it's classified in your supermarket, and there they are.
Yeah. In the supermarket that I go to most often, they're near the seafood department.
Right.
Yeah, well, sometimes you have to kind of hunt around for these things, if they.
Right, and that's why when you get to know your own supermarket, it's a lot easier. When you go to a new one, you're like, "Where would they put this?"
Yeah, because sometimes they might have a special international section.
Yeah,
and it might be there.
Right,
or it might be with the breadcrumbs that come in a tube.
And panko makes a wonderful breading for seafood too, because they're so crisp and they stay so crunchy. Even after you saute something.
Yeah.
They're really great, yeah.
Speaking of asparagus, is there a recipe in here now that I'm thinking about that perhaps it's another Paula Wolfert where she fries capers?
Yeah.
That sounds good. Talk with us about that.
Is a wonderful recipe, and this is a recipe from her book, Slow Mediterranean Kitchen. And asparagus baked in parchment paper. So you make little packets and of like little pouches that you put thick asparagus spears with a little bit of olive oil, some salt, a little bit of tarragon. So you have that wonderful sweet licorice-y flavor of tarragon. And they get baked for 1.5 to 2 hours.
But slowly.
175 degrees. But what you get is this incredible sweetness just candy-like sweetness that comes out when you cook them that slowly. And because they're in these little pouches of parchment paper, it seals in all the juices, you know. So it's this wonderful little, it's kind of a braise, you know, if you will. But they're steamed in all their sweetness and little olive oil. And then meanwhile, you soak some capers and make a little mayonnaise dipping sauce for the asparagus when it comes out. I'm trying to think. Well, there's one where the capers get fried, and that's a different asparagus recipe, and that's the Roseanne Gold recipe.
Okay.
And what all that is that's similar. It's funny, we have three asparagus recipes, and there you go. That's an example of, you know, suddenly everybody's roasting asparagus. And that's oven roasted asparagus again. But what you top it with are these fried capers. And the thing about capers is that capers are the little buds of a nasturtium-like plant,
mm-hmm.
and they're unopened flower buds. But when you fry them, they bloom, they burst, and it's almost like they bloom, and they become wonderfully sort of crunchy. You fry them in a little bit of olive oil, and brings out all their flavor. They have. Especially if you use salt-packed capers,
mm-hmm.
Which are the bigger ones. But any caper will do. You just want to make sure you dry them really well before you put them in the hot oil because they'll splatter so much. But there's actually, in the next edition, the one that's coming out this fall, there's a wonderful beet salad that's also served with these fried capers.
Yeah.
So you get the sweetness of the beets and then this sort of earthiness and crunchiness of the fried capers. I love them. I put them on everything from fried eggs to pasta to.
Wow.
Yeah. And once you find a little technique like that, it's really fun to just use it for lots of things. They're good in salads, too. You know, maybe you put toasted nuts in a salad, but fried capers could take the place.
Yeah. Well, I was thinking that they would be good on another vegetable like cauliflower.
Yeah. Yeah. Be wonderful. Yeah.
You pair that sweet and the salty.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that'd be great. And the bigger the capers, the more dramatic they'll be when you fry them. And you basically rinse them and then make sure they're very, very dry and then just heat some a little bit of extra virgin olive oil in a small pan and drop them in.
Yeah.
Just a minute, they'll pop. You see them, they sort of pop open. I mean, not quite as dramatic as a popcorn kernel popping, but certainly they do burst open.
I wonder, you know, how do you discover something like this? I mean, is it a technique that's been around forever, or, well, the technique of frying something or sautéing something certainly has been around for a long, long time, but, you know, how do you come across the idea of, like, why don't we fry these?
Yeah, that's a great question, and I think a lot of time it's traveling to someplace and seeing that that's the way they do it, you know, and have always done it. And if you think about capers from the Mediterranean, it's a way to preserve. That's what they were originally done, as a way to preserve them. So my guess, without doing lots of research, would be that it was just another way to serve them.
Mm.
But yeah, it's always funny how somebody comes upon something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, my husband and I discovered how good herbs can be if they're fried.
Yeah.
And then they taste wonderful then on top of potatoes.
Mm.
And then several years ago, we were watching television, and it was the two hot tamales.
Yes.
And they took leaves of spinach, washed them, dried them, and fried them.
Yep.
And that's a terrific idea, too.
Yeah, and you flash fry them, of course.
Right.
But you get the crunchiness of them. I love what it does for herbs too. You're right. Even a few just sage leaves that you fry before you put on, you know, just a few,
mm-hmm.
makes a big difference.
But parsley and
mm-hmm.
rosemary.
Yeah.
Terrific.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, before we wrap up here, is there something you would like to share with us? One more recipe that would be fairly simple and quick. Maybe you would talk with us about the minted pea soup.
That's exactly the recipe that I was going to, and I thought, and I was hesitated for a minute because we've done a couple soups, we've talked about soups,
yeah.
But this is such a great recipe, and this is when I travel and teach a lot, and this is when I love to teach because you can do it year-round. It's very simple and very good. So, and it's a Jamie Oliver recipe who's just a lot of fun if people are into, you know, some of the celebrity chefs around. He's one who continues to deliver. but the great thing about this soup is the garnish. And what you do is you take about a half a loaf of day-old bread and tear it into little bite-sized pieces. Instead of cutting it into croutons, you tear it.
Mm-hmm.
And by tearing it, you get all these wonderful rough edges. And you put those in a roasting pan with a little bit of olive oil, some mint leaves, and then some chopped up pancetta or bacon, which is pancetta being the Italian bacon, just cut up into little dice, and then put that into a 350 oven. Toss it all together so you've got breadcrumbs, olive oil, mint, salt, pepper, and bacon or pancetta, and roast it for about 20 minutes and stir it a few times. So the bread toasts up, the bacon cooks, everything gets a little lot crunchy, salty, savory. And then, meanwhile, you make a very simple pea soup using scallions, cook scallions in a little bit of butter with some fresh mint and add frozen peas, unless you have really, really good fresh peas, which this time of year are probably almost gone, but ours are gone. And then some chicken broth and simmer it, add a little bit of heavy cream, and simmer it until everything's tender and then puree it. So you've just got a very simple, you know, it's just the scallion, the peas, a little bit of broth, and mint. So not a very complexly flavored soup, but very fresh. And then you sprinkle this garnish of the crouton, you know, the bread, the toasted bread and the pancetta on top. Such a good soup. I make that little breadcrumb bacon garnish for salads. I have to make more than it because I'll snack on the whole pan of it. It's so good.
Yeah. And it's such a terrific recipe. I mean, this is a year-round thing, frozen peas.
Yeah. And the thing about frozen, I'm a huge fan of fresh vegetables in my farmer's market and everything else, and I love fresh peas, but fresh peas last about 6 hours from when you get them because they turn to starch so quickly.
Yeah.
And frozen peas really do keep their quality quite, you know, their sweetness, because they're frozen at their peak of sweetness. So,
yeah.
Okay. That's a great one.
Well, thank you so much for talking with me this afternoon.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
I really enjoyed it. Molly Stevens, she is one of the editors. She's co-editor with Fran McCullough of the Best American Recipes series, the one that's currently out there, the 2004-2005 edition, the next one coming this fall. The publisher, Houghton Mifflin. It's 1:53. Settlement prices are in from the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Todd Gleason.
Thanks much, Celeste. From the Chicago Board of Trade, this afternoon, futures finished the day like this in the wheat pit after trading lower today. For a good portion of the day, the wheat managed to rally back, as did the corn and the oil seeds to some extent. In the oil seeds, they just came off of their lows. The corn and the wheat both rallying back to above unchanged and finished up a 1 to 4 cents for the day. That is the weather forecasters at noon turned their attention to the 6 to 10 day and called for hotter and drier conditions across the Midwest. Not as much impact in the bean pit, as most traders are confident that beans are an August crop and they still have some time to make a crop. But on the other hand, the corn futures deciding corn simply can't waste any more time during this pollination period, and they pushed the market a bit higher for the day. September futures in the wheat pit now. Soft red winter wheat at 354 on the high, the low at 342.5. A settlement price at $3.52 1/4, up 3 3/4. Wheat, of course, following corn up, as it can be a substitute for feedstuffs if not enough corn is available during the growing season or during the year, as a short crop would be used up. December contract 368.5, the high, the low at 356. Settlement price at 367. They were up 4 3/4. March futures at 381 high. Low at 368.5. Settlement price there, $3.80 a bushel. They were up 4 3/4 on the day. Don't have the high and the low for the May contract. Do have the settlement price, 382, up 3 for the day. July futures at 383 high, low at 372. July up next year, wheat, 382. The settlement price up 4 1/4 on the day. From the corn pit, nearby September futures, 263, the high, the low, 253.5. A settlement price at $2.60. They were up 2 1/4 in December's, 273 the high, the low at 263, settled at 270. They were up 2 for the day in the March contract at 276 high, the low at 267, settled 273.5, up 1.5. The May contract 276, the high, the low at 270, settled 276, up 3.5 cents for that May corn contract. In July futures, 278 the high, low at 270, settlement price at $2.76 3/4, up 2 for the day. September futures for next year, 266 the high, the low at 62.5, and a settlement price at $2.65 1/2 cents for the September 2006 corn contract, and it finished the day one higher. Hey, don't forget to join us Tuesday evening at Terre Haute Grain, when we'll bring a marketing ag panel including Paul Cooley and Wayne Nelson, Kay Whitlock, and Andy Knutson at 7 o'clock to the lower level in the meeting room just below the Terre Haute Grain elevator. You're invited. It's absolutely free. Terre Haute Grain is right in Terre Haute, at the crossroads of Route 41 and Voorhees Street. That's at 7 o'clock tomorrow evening. We hope to see you there. September Oats from the Board of Trade. 181, the high, the low at 178 and three quarters. Settled at 180 and a quarter, down 2 and a quarter for the day. December futures, 184 and a half, the high, the low at 182. Settled at 184 and a half, down a quarter cent. August soybeans, 724 and a half high, low at 709, settled $7.17 and a quarter, down 3 and 3 quarters. In the September's, 729 the high, the low at 713, settled 720 and 3 quarters, down 3 and 3 quarters. November contract in the bean pit, 735 and a half the high, the low at 718 and a half, settled 727 and 3 quarters, down 3 and 3 quarters. And the January futures, 737 the high, the low at 720, settled at 729. They were down 2.5. The March contract is 727 high, low at 714, settled 719.5, off 3 for the day. May beans, 709 the high, the low at 697, settled 703.5, down 3.5 in the 06 contract. Bean meal, August contract to settlement price there at 224.20. They were off 250 for the day. SEPs, 224.30, down 220. And the August bean oil, 25.54, up 6 on the day. September contract at 25.63 was up 1 for the day. Now here's Celeste Quinn with the numbers from the Mercantile Exchange.
Thank you, Todd. August feeder cattle, 106.75, the high 105.50, the low, the settlement 106.20, that up a nickel. September, 105.47 and a half, the high 104.17 and a half, the low, the settlement 104.77 and a half, up 7 and a half. October, 104.27 and a half, the high, the low 102.95. That's the low, the settlement 103.80, that up 22.5. August live cattle 78.87 and a half, the high, the low 78.20, the settlement 78.50, that down 2.5. October 81.22 and a half, the high 80.50, the low 80.77 and a half, the settlement, that down 42.5. August lean hog 67.20, the high 65.75, the low, the settlement 67 even, that up 125. October 58.35, the high 57.20, the low 57.95, the settlement, that up 37.5. December 55.80, the high 54.85, the low, the settlement 55.57.5, up 62.5. February 57.60, the high 56.85, the low 57.57.5, the settlement, that up 47.5. July bellies 65.20, the high 64.70, the low, the settlement 65.10, that up 190. The Dow is off 50 points, the NASDAQ down 9, the S&P 500 off 5.
Agricultural programming on WILL is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 85 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers.
It's time once again to Ask Dr. Science. So let's ask Dr. Science.
That's me.
Remember, he knows more than you do.
That's right.
Lee Davis from Northport, Alabama.